This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So what I wanted to start with is just that where we're heading, and I'm not going to talk a lot about DSM-5 today, but where we're heading is a conception of autism that is really not very different from DSM-4, but just the idea that we have two domains, social communication and restricted and repetitive behaviors, and that there is something special about individuals who have basic difficulties in social communication and also something repetitive or restricted. And then in addition, and you'll hear this in sort of everything that we do throughout the longitudinal study, often, not always, these difficulties are accompanied by expressive language problems and also receptive. But that if you're trying to diagnose autism, you have to keep in mind how well someone can talk, because how well you can talk affects every aspect of social communication, including your nonverbal communication, and it also affects the degree to which you will have flexible behavior. In addition, and this just feeds into everything I'll say later, having ASD does not protect you from having other problems, and it actually increases the risk that you can have a whole host of problems that all kinds of people have, but which do affect both behavior and physical development. And one of the things I think we've learned from this longitudinal study is that those issues are there, and they're not minor. I'm also coming at this from the basic assumption that autism is a neurobiological disorder of learning and processing. And that's not anything that's particularly unusual to say to this group. But the assumption is that it's a developmental disorder and that having ASD affects all the information, or almost all the information, that you take in that is going to then affect your ability to learn what to do next. And then in turn, it affects your opportunities for learning. So that if you are a child who is not paying attention to people when they walk into the room, you're less likely to notice of something that they're going to tell you about or something they're paying attention to. And so you're getting on the boat when it's halfway out the marina. So what I'm going to do today is focus particularly on one longitudinal study that we've been doing now for 20 years. We followed about 200 children. We started with about 200 consecutive referrals for possible autism, most of whom we did think had autism. All of these kids were the kids referred to 5 different teach centers in North Carolina before age 3. So we were actually able to see every single kid that was referred into these programs. So it wasn't a hit or miss deal. And then we did the same thing over again in Chicago. So every kid that was referred to an autism clinic under age 3. And we saw these kids at 2, 3, some at 4, all or as many as we could at 5, at 9. We then collected yearly data, and actually in some cases 3 monthly data from the families between 9 and 19. Saw many of them at 14. And then we've seen about 120 of them at 19. And we're just actually starting to see them again at 22. So just saw the first 8 again. We started this study with the idea that maybe some of the initial reports, for example, Lovas's, where they said that treatment resulted in 50% of the kids becoming indistinguishable from typical kids, maybe they didn't even know who they were diagnosing, that maybe they didn't know what autism was in 2-year-olds, and that maybe there would be much more flux in who got a diagnosis and how these diagnoses changed in young kids. So the first question was just, are diagnoses of autism reliable at these very young ages? I think another question was, given the heterogeneity of autism, how different children and adults with autism are from each other, what is common to this disorder? But then we also wanted across time to look at what was different. We were particularly interested in changes in behavior that accompanied development and what are the trajectories of those changes. And then the influences of different factors that are not specific to autism, like language, expressive language, receptive language, and behavior problems, aggression, irritability, on the way that we see ASD. And why do we care about this? I mean, why do we care about trajectories? Why do we care about changes over time? I mean, the first thing that I think is most striking to parents is predicting what is ahead. I think the trouble is here, we're not trying to say that anything is fixed. But what we can say is what happened to these children, I mean, referred 20 years ago, so they're not the same kids as would be seen in a clinic today, referred under age 3. They're more intellectually disabled. And these parents 20 years ago were pretty brave to take on the possibility that their kids had diagnoses of autism at age 2. But what we're trying to do is, at least from their example, look at what can we tell from 2 to 5 to 9 about what's going to a child is going to be like as a young adult at 19. We also want to use this information to select targets for intervention. If things are getting better no matter what we do, then maybe we don't need to obsess so much about intervening. If other things are not changing, or if we see change and that change predicts a better outcome, maybe that's something that we should be targeting as something we really want to focus on. From that point of view, we want to know when to intervene and also what do we need to assess in order to determine what to intervene. We're also interested in the relationships between features of ASD and features of ASD and other factors. And we hope that these findings will provide clues to clusters of behaviors that way we can link back to neurobiology and then come back forwards to what does this mean about this disorder. So I had done a tiny little study when I was in Canada where I'd seen 30 kids referred for possible autism at age 2. And that literally was like a one-woman show where I did the ADI, then I did the ADI while the child was sitting at my feet, and then I'd get on the floor and do the ADOS, and then I'd get back up and talk to the parents. And with that, working with a child psychiatrist who saw these kids later, we looked at features that at 2 seemed to predict that these kids really did have autism and still had it at 3. When I moved to North Carolina, I was determined to do this, but do it in a better way. So what we wanted to do was have multiple measures of what the kids were like when they were 2 and as outcome measures. We wanted to use both parent reports and direct observations. We wanted to have a systematic way of collecting consecutive referrals that weren't just whoever I happened to see. And we wanted to have a more diverse population. And I'm just showing you the 9-year-old data because it's sort of right in the middle of the study. But you can see these are just the kids who at some point or other had an ASD diagnosis. And you can see that by 9, we had 170 kids left in the sample out of about 200. We have a minority, but quite a significant sample of African-American kids. We have mostly boys, which is not surprising. The average time we met these kids was 28 and 29 months of age. The 9 you'll see is an average of actually them being 10 and actually 8.5. And you can see by the IQs that this is a sample of kids with more intellectual disability than we would see, again, if we took consecutive referrals in clinics today. There's a huge range, if you look in the last 2 columns, of people from very high intelligence to very, very significantly intellectually disabled kids. But when we looked at change in diagnosis, having independent people see the kids at 9 who did not know anything about their initial diagnosis, the most dominant thing we found was that on the whole, the diagnoses of autism were quite consistent across time. So that's, I guess it's not working, but that's the 76 kids who got diagnosed with autism at 2. Of those kids, only one child had moved out of the spectrum by 9. PDD was more variable, but in fact, in this study, and I don't think this would happen today, we had many kids who moved from PDD diagnoses into autism diagnoses, because when we saw them at 2, we thought they were so cute and pretty social, and we were reluctant to call them autistic. Yet, in fact, by the time they were 9, it was clear they had autism. But there's more variability there in terms of kids moving out of the spectrum. And then we actually did have 2 kids whom we knew right away, actually, who we said at 2, they do not have autism. We offered them treatment. By a month later, we knew we were wrong, and they did. But those are the kids that moved into autism. But on the whole, the diagnosis was much more stable from 2 to 9 than we expected. And the one big change, again, was this moving from PDD to autism, which is one of the reasons why we don't want to have the PDD diagnosis in DSM-5, because we feel like it's confusing. We also found that when you have an intersection of the blue of a direct observation, such as the PLADAS, and parent information, such as the ADI, and a clinical judgment, then you get much more stable diagnoses. So the center in there, you can see that's the percent of kids that we were actually able to predict the 9-year-old diagnosis. If you just have one source of information, so if you just do an ADOS and take the scores literally, you will be much less good at predicting who actually has a diagnosis. And so that's not surprising, but I think it's continued to be true. When we looked at what clinical predictors from age 2, sorry, what predictors predicted diagnosis at 9 from age 2, the clinical diagnosis, and then much to our surprise, repetitive behaviors at 2, both on the ADOS, which we thought, the ADOS is like half an hour, 40 minutes. How many repetitive behaviors are you going to see? But in fact, if you saw them at 2, it was quite predictive of a consistent diagnosis of autism at 9. Our observations of social behavior, so in the ADOS at 2, also predicted later diagnosis. Parent report measures were less good. And part of it was at age 2, many of the parents didn't have other kids, didn't have a good sense of all the things that a typical child can do. And so we're much less able to describe their kids in the context of what is normal behavior. That was not so. Even by age 3, that had changed. Parent reports of communication, though, were better than what we saw in the ADOS. So parents were really quite good at being able to say, I can ask my child to go get something from another room, or he would never be able to do that. And then verbal skill, which seems amazing, but at 2, verbal IQ was actually a predictor of diagnosis at 9. And here, these are trajectory tables where we try to group kids from 2, and these actually go all the way up to 14, on the basis of ADOS scores. And one of the things that we were really surprised by was that the 2 groups on the right each contained 40% of the sample. So on the whole, about 40% of the kids, each red line is a child. And these are ADOS severity scores from a 10 being very severe, a 4 meaning sort of just in the spectrum, and a 2 meaning or a 0 meaning not clear evidence of being in the spectrum. On the whole, 80% of the sample stayed within that same range from the time they were 2 up till the time they were 14. That we were not expecting. On the other hand, if you look at the bottom left-hand corner, we did have 10% of the sample whose scores went steadily down. So there actually were 10% of the sample of kids whose ADOS scores, again by independent administrators who didn't know what the kid had gotten before, improved, and pretty steadily. There were not these dramatic gains, like from 2 to 3 and then whoop, out, but steadily down with some variability. We also had another 10% of the sample that we called worsening, but in fact, if you look at the scores, about half of those kids are just right in the middle, and it's just a sort of statistical result that they got put in this worsening group. But there were 5% of the kids who got worse. And this is just looking at ADOS scores. This is not everything else. This gives you an example, actually, of individual kids and how their scores changed over time. And what we have done is worked on having these severity scores of the ADOS, which allow you to compute a score so you can compare scores across modules and across time. Now, the disadvantage of these scores is that they compare kids to other kids of the same language level and the same age. So the reality is, if you have a lot of language and you can get a Module 3 of the ADOS, that is a really good thing. And this controls for that. So this is saying, compared to other kids your age who got a Module 3, who have a lot of language, this is how autistic you are. But again, what you have to remember is it's better to have that language. So this isn't severity in life. This is severity on the ADOS. What it does mean is if we were truly curing kids, they should have zeros or twos. So if you have a child who's got a lot of language, is getting a Module 3, so is really talking your ear off, that's great. But if they get an ADOS score of 10, they are doing a lot of things while they're talking that show autism. We then took these trajectories and these different groups and looked at how verbal IQ changed for the kids in those classes. So if you look at the green, these are the kids. The green are kids who were in that improving group. Remember the 10%. And what you can see is that their verbal IQs start to shoot up even between 2 and 3. And really, they make quite amazing progress. If you look at the red line, the kids in the worsening group actually fall in the middle. And that's partly because you can't get worse if you're absolutely already at the bottom. So again, there's sort of statistical flukes of this. You can see that most kids, and that's the broken up line, do show improvements, the third line down, but that it's slower and less dramatic than the kids who made the radical improvements. And then what I want you to see is this is daily living skills from the Vineland. So the point that I want to make here is that the trajectories of just these two examples are quite different. For the kids, remember that dramatic increase in the green at the top in verbal skills. You're looking at the same kids, you don't get that dramatic increase in daily living skills in those same early years, or actually ever, but you do have slower but steady improvements. And that's also true, actually, for pretty much all the kids, but not as dramatically. Another question is, how much is the social affect score related to the repetitive behavior score? That is, how many kids, if you have really a lot of repetitive behavior, and that's what these three groups are, okay, the mild, middle, and high levels, what happens to your social affect? And again, this is all on the ADOS, so this is all based on just an observation in 40 minutes, not the whole life of the child. But what you can see is that if you have a lot of repetitive behavior, you're going to have the chances of you having really good social behavior in the ADOS is low. On the other hand, having mild repetitive behaviors doesn't guarantee you great social skills. And that's one of the interesting things, both about repetitive behaviors, because there's much more variability in what they're associated with if you stay in the mild to moderate range. it makes sense. I mean, I just saw a child who was really, his dad said he's hemmed in by his obsession with Subways. His whole life is hemmed in. I mean, that's mixing your metaphors, isn't it? But he is so caught up in worrying about what Subway car he's going to end up on in New York that he doesn't want to go out the door because he might end up in the wrong car. And that makes him, when he gets in the wrong car, he screams. He's 11. He's a very bright boy, but he can still scream like a banshee. And this does not make him a popular child. It also doesn't make him really well-liked in school because he wants to talk about Subways all the time. And nobody else is quite that interested. So, as we've said before, there's a huge range, though, in language levels, and this is expressive language, as kids move through from basically 2 up to about 12. And each one of these lines is a different child. These are only the kids who actually got autism diagnoses. So it doesn't even include the kids who got PDD diagnoses. The broken line would be typical development. So you can see we have some kids who are actually shooting up faster and better than an ordinary kid. We also have kids who are very close to that, and we have many kids who have quite severe language deficits. And I think one thing we were really encouraged by, because this is a sample, again, remember, that is less able than we would expect kids to be today who come in a 2-year-old clinic, that even at age 9, we had about 40% of both the samples from Chicago and North Carolina who had truly complex language. We only had 14% of the kids who were really nonverbal, meaning fewer than 5 words used on a daily basis. And my guess is that this would be much better today. And then last one of these trajectory slides, you can tell I like these slides, is just to see over time, is we looked at grouping kids by trajectory of expressive language development. And so if you start with a thick blue line, the thickness of the line shows the proportion of kids in this group. This is all the way up to age 19. 30% of the kids actually had, they're the baseline. So we have 30% of the kids who had a pretty steady acquisition of language, but very slow. If you look at, the broken line at the top, those are the kids who make the most progress. And you can see the way that we've made the graph, 9 and 19 is really condensed. So those are kids who at 19 are at age level in language. But again, a pretty straight progression. But what we do have, and I think this is an encouraging note, is we do have some kids who truly did have delays, but then catch up. So if you look at the thick red line and the line just above it, those are kids that actually end up quite a bit higher than you would have expected from where they were at 2 and at 3. So there are some kids. It's not a huge number. But again, about 20% of kids with autism who don't have just a straight slope of development, but who really do lag just like other kids with language delay, and then begin to get momentum. And actually, with the two groups, the straight line up at the top next to the broken line, actually really end up being fine at 19 in terms of language level. So I think the point of this is just that we need to be very careful, first of all, to remember and not make over-positive statements that most of the slopes are linear, but also to remember that there is hope because there are these kids who have delays. It does happen, and we want to be really careful not to slow down and not to write off kids that are starting slow, especially in that year between 2 and 3. Now, one encouraging thing that we have found is that there are nice correlations across the ADI, which is a long parent interview the RBSR, which is a parent questionnaire, and actually in one case in the ADOS, between some of these aspects of repetitive behavior. And I think this just suggests that we're not just looking at unique, weird things that happen during the ADOS, for example. So RSM is repetitive stereotyped mannerisms, and that actually is, which is from parent report, is highly correlated with the ADOS. And so again, seeing this in a unique 40-minute segment and then actually with a questionnaire. You can see that there are similar correlations between IQ and repetitive behaviors, which are pretty high. But there's also correlations between IS's insistence on sameness in the red and the sameness variable in the RBSR, between self-injury, which is not so surprising, but and between descriptions of circumscribed interest and restricted behavior. This may not seem so astonishing, but to actually get correlations between a parent report of a lifetime of a certain behavior and seeing it in a 40-minute observation is really something that doesn't happen that often. And we don't get such good correlations for social behavior, in part because what we see in a 40-minute segment is not necessarily what happens everywhere else, and is certainly not necessarily what a parent sees across a lifetime. We also get different trajectories across across the different kinds of repetitive behaviors. So in fact, for repetitive stereotype mannerisms, there's a group of kids who across time, the behaviors become actually more obvious, and then typically they remain close to the same. For brighter kids, often these behaviors are able to control these behaviors, so they decrease. But in fact, when you listen to parent reports, they often are still present. They're just less conspicuous. Whereas for insistence on sameness, actually, we have a group of kids who do them from the very start, even starting at 2, but there are also a group of kids who begin to do these more obviously between 3 and 4. And I think part of that may be kids are more mobile, they're making more choices about what they can do, but part of it is, I think, that they actually do develop stronger feelings about what they should be doing than they had when they're 2. And then last set of these trajectories, this is looking at changes in behavior problems. Where I'm going with all these different graphs is just that there are lots of different slopes and different trajectories for different behaviors. There isn't an autism trajectory. There's a trajectory for insistence on sameness. There are trajectories for repetitive behaviors. For hyperactivity and irritability, almost everybody gets better over time. The three different groups are actually autism, PDD, and non-spectrum. But for social withdrawal, this is the lethargy category from that ABC, for those of you who know it. We actually see a beginning an increase, which in fact it does keep going up for the ASD group, the autism and PDD kids, as described by their parents. So even though the kids are getting less irritable, are less hyperactive, the parents actually describe them as less interested in interacting with them. And you could say, well, that may be normal adolescence, which to some extent it might. But actually, the non-spectrum, parents of the non-spectrum kids who mostly have developmental disabilities don't describe that. We were really surprised that a number of the things that we thought might predict outcome, and this is up to age 19, didn't. So gender, we don't have thousands of girls. We have between 20 and 30 girls, depending on the age. But we didn't. We have so much heterogeneity within each gender that gender itself did not predict differences. We didn't get any kind of race or ethnic difference. Basically, this sample is African-American kids and white kids. We didn't get specific effects of puberty. And the way we measured them was having parents fill out Tanner scales every 3 months from the time the kids were 9 to 16. I think the parents were ready to kill us, probably, of running in and checking their child's body to see if they were going to tick off a change. But at least on the basis of that, we get changes gradually across adolescence, but there was nothing particularly tied to puberty. And we didn't get any association between behavior changes and adolescence onset of seizures. The reason we had the poor parents filling out these forms every 3 months was we thought we might get a prodromal effect of behavior problems increasing and then seizures, or seizures and then an increase in behavior problems. We didn't get that. So when we're looking at age 19, one of the questions is, what is an optimal outcome? And I think this has been discussed a lot recently because of Debbie Fine's paper. Are there kids with the optimal outcomes, and what does this mean? Now, I think we first started looking in the sample at 19, and these are all the kids. So in this case, there are 85 kids where we have complete data. So these were kids who were seen by somebody who didn't know anything about them from before. Okay. We did differentially lose more African-American kids and more kids whose families were less well-educated. Mostly it's because we just couldn't find them. We think cell phones have just done us in terms of being able to track people down. But we didn't lose kids differentially by diagnosis, as far as we could tell, at least 2-year-old and 9-year-old diagnoses. So if we first start and divide the sample just by having a nonverbal IQ of 70, so basically a child with an intellectual disability or without an intellectual disability, you can see that we didn't have big differences at 2 in the diagnosis of ASD, but we have at age 9, we have fewer kids who got a diagnosis of ASD. We didn't have big age effects. We didn't have effects of North Carolina versus Chicago. We didn't have effects of ethnicity. We didn't have actually very large effects, or not a significant effect, of seizures. So these are just showing you lack of differences. But when you look at this, this is not a sample where we're cutting at IQ of 70, where the mean IQ of the kids below 70 is 65 and above 70 is 75. If you look at the verbal IQ of the kids below 70, they are very low. And part of this is the measures. We have to end up using preschool measures to assess their language because they can't do more. But our more able group are really average intelligence, or really above. Our less able group are quite severely intellectually disabled. And if you look at social delays, this is just the ADOS social score. You can see the less able kids have lower adaptive skills, higher ADOS scores. They have more repetitive behaviors, more irritability, and more hyperactivity. This is right now at 19. They're also much more likely to be taking medication for behavior. This just shows you a verbal IQ distributed by group. And where I'm going, actually, is that we're going to pull out 8 of the 32 kids who had IQs over 70 who really look like now they do not have a diagnosis. So when they were seen by somebody who didn't know a history, and we have, again, in the sample, kids who had non-spectrum diagnoses, so they're mixed in, I'm not talking about them. People did not know that they were from the autism group. But what I want you to see here is these are their IQs. On the top is at age 2, and at the bottom at age 19. And the IQs at 2 were not really different between the more able group and the optimal group, whereas they're very different from the less able group. So then if we move on just to compare this optimal group, and we've actually switched, but I didn't change the slide because I couldn't squish it in. We've decided we're going to call them very positive as rather than optimal, because optimal just has somehow a ring of surety that is we don't want to have. But you can see that there isn't a significant difference in IQ, although the optimal kids are higher, but it's not significant. there is a significant difference in adaptive scores, which is partly circular in the sense that the kids in the optimal group or very positive group can do more for themselves. But in addition to that, the kids in the more able group have significantly more behavioral concerns. They're more irritable, they're more hyperactive, and they're also more depressed. I think the point of this is that we get so focused, maybe you don't, but at least our group gets so focused on autism that we think the only thing that makes a difference are autistic features. But the reality is one of the discriminating factors here between the young people with high IQs who are not doing as well with ASD and those who are doing better are these other factors, the irritability, the hyperactivity, and the depression. And you could argue what comes first, and I don't know, but it's a real factor. And then if you look at these kids were 19 when we saw them. So many of them were in college, actually. I think all of the very positive group were in college. So not living independently is not a terrible thing because they were living at home and going to college. But you can see that 63% of the very positive group was actually living independently at school compared to 13% of the more able. 88% were in college. Many of the kids also had part-time jobs, and they were less likely to be taking medication. This just shows you their verbal IQs at 2 and 19, and LA is less able. So if you go from blue at 2 to 19 is the green, you can see the less able kids, the verbal IQs remained relatively stable, whereas both the more able group, but who still clearly had ASD, and this very positive group made huge differences in IQ. So my point here is that increase in IQ, remember the curve that we saw of the kids who did well, is probably necessary for this optimal outcome, but it's not sufficient. You know, it doesn't promise you that you're going to do great just because you have good verbal skills, but you do need to have those skills in our society to survive independently. And then the last thing is just what did differentiate this group? And one of the things we were really surprised by was that repetitive behaviors, changes in repetitive behaviors, even between 2 and 3, differentiated the more able group from the most optimal or very positive group. And I'll show you in a minute. In addition, hyperactivity, and this is just by parent report at age 3, also differentiated the more able group from the very positive outcome. And then the last thing, and it really is puny, but I think it means something, is that most of these kids in this study were in North Carolina and in Chicago. In neither of those states, between 2 and 3, did they have access to intensive intervention, unless their parents did extraordinary things. So the number of hours of intervention that these kids got between 2 and 3, remember, most of them we met when they were 2.5, was very small in most cases. If the child got more than 20 hours of treatment, which in most cases would be about 1 hour a week, then they ended up in this last group. So that we did have a significant difference between the proportion of kids in the optimal outcome group who got 20 hours or more of treatment, again, once a week or more, but not much, okay, versus the more able group. Now, I think what this probably means is not that the treatment caused their very positive outcome, but perhaps just that the parents took this on. These were the mildest kids, the brightest kids, the least severe kids, and yet their parents still did something about it. And my guess is that treatment is just a marker for somebody doing something about this. We can't measure what the outcome of these kids would be with intensive treatment because they didn't get it. You know, On the whole, in our sample, we had 20 kids who got intensive ABA, and they were all kids who had very severe problems. Their parents sought out the intensive ABA because their kids weren't making progress. So it's not a fair comparison. Again, this just shows you what I've said before. If you look in the upper left, this is the more able group, and then the optimal group had very similar trajectories of IQ, but quite different from the less able kids. In adaptive skills, again, similar trajectories. We see the decrease in adaptive skills in less able kids that people have reported in other kinds of studies. If we go down to the bottom, we see this decrease in repetitive behaviors for the optimal group, while the more able kids increase and the less able kids stay high. And then the last thing is on the bottom left, we look at social delays and we have a different trajectory again, which is a much more gradual change and similar across the optimal and more able kids between 2 and 3. So my point here is the social skills are not changing at the same pace as the repetitive behaviors. They're changing in a different trajectory. And with these optimal kids, all of these kids had a diagnosis but one, actually. So there's 8 of them. One of them at 2 looked quite autistic. At 3, we weren't sure. By 4, he really didn't look autistic at all. But all of the other kids had diagnoses at 14. So this social change, they were doing well, occurred much more slowly than the changes in repetitive behaviors, the changes in adaptive skills, and particularly the changes in language. Now, maybe this is something we can do better with more intensive, more socially directed treatment. I think that's where we want to go. So just to wrap this up, one of the pathways that we saw, and I sort of talked about this but not very specifically, was a particular combination of kids who had high behavior problems, lots of repetitive behaviors, often had aggression, negative affect, and poor adaptive behaviors. And those were the kids that had the hardest time and are associated with the parents having the greatest stress. I think one of the hard things there is whether we can identify them young enough and figure out what to do with them. Because I think one of the things we often do, or at least I see with the families that I meet, is you meet a 2-year-old and then parents are like, all right, it's autism. Some families are like, put me to work. What are we going to do? And other families are like, okay, let's just see how it goes. And I think the point here is, if you have a child with a lot of repetitive behaviors, a lot of aggression, negative affect, and poor adaptive behavior, which may mean not toilet trained, may mean not feeding themselves, basic things, then we really want to get going. We don't want to just wait for this child to cheer up and have an easier time. Another pathway that we saw was kids who developed more depressive symptoms in adolescence. And when these kids were not only depressed or sad, but also anxious and had strong resistance to change, this seemed to confound everything. And that was another group of kids, I think, that again, verbally may be doing great, but are not going to just pop into happiness without specific treatments. And often our treatments aren't aimed at these kinds of things. Our focus is on early intervention. I think in addition, we need to build models that include strengths. And part of it is that we don't really know how to do that. But it's clear that having good verbal skills really does make a difference. It doesn't promise you anything, but it can carry a child far. I think we did find that kids could be reliably diagnosed with autism as young as age 2. There is that change between 2 and 3, but on the whole, the autistic symptoms did not go away. What we got were changes in language and changes in a diminution in repetitive behaviors. I didn't talk about it, but verbal skills, even at 2, were strongly predictive of outcome at 19, which I still find, I just wish it weren't true, actually, because we're talking about giving essentially nonverbal kids a Mullen and saying this is very predictive. But it's more predictive at 3 than at 2. And I think what that should do is give us hope that we just need to get going between 2 and 3 and figure out how we can make those improvements. A higher proportion of kids had complex language and spontaneous phrases at 9 than we ever would have expected in this sample, which was a pretty intellectually disabled sample. And what I don't have, and I should have, is data for you about what happened at 19. It also is the case that we had about 20% of those kids, even though the predictions are quite strong, even from 2, we have 20% of the kids who really do make quite marked progress from 2 to 3 and keep making their progress. So there is a catch-up phenomenon in a minority of kids. And these are, again, kids without a lot of intervention. I think verbal IQs were already improving from 2 to 3 and continued to improve from 5 to 9. And so I think there we need to be very careful, again, that having a very low score is not good news. Having a verbal IQ of 70 at 2 is not that bad. And we would predict that that is very likely to go up to 80 to 90 on up. So although I'm talking about the power of prediction, I'm not talking about writing off kids who have scores that are close or within this sort of average range, average meaning very broad. I also think that changes in social behavior were more gradual than just about anything. And that makes sense because you think of how complicated it is to figure out how to behave with other people. I think that means a lot of things. I think it means that early interventions need to emphasize social behavior more, which certainly things like ESDM do. That was not the case when we were doing discrete trial or teach, actually, 20 years ago. We weren't emphasizing social behavior. That kind of just tagged along. But I also think it means that we need to have continued social interventions and help, even for the kids with a lot of verbal skills who may get placed in a regular kindergarten or are actually doing fine academically in fifth grade. If they're struggling socially, we want that we still have room to make improvements, and we don't want to just stop. And then repetitive behaviors were just more important than we thought, and I don't know what this means. I don't know neurologically, I don't know behaviorally, but it does mean that we want to, if anything, redirect kids. I don't think we want to punish them, we don't want to make them stop these things, but we definitely, if we can get them to do other things, there seems to be some indication that outcome will be better. But I think that one of the reasons why I wanted to move away from optimal outcome and just didn't have enough skill to change my slides is that I think there are places for very positive outcome that are not necessarily meaning shedding autism completely. I think one of the questions is, what does it mean to move out of a diagnosis? And I think in most cases, that isn't like you jump off a cliff. You know, it's that there are, I mean, what is amazing about those 8 guys is that they have, you know, if you saw them, you would not know from their facial expressions, their voice, their eye contact, the way they move, that they have autism. And that is an amazing thing because they really were, having known them since they were 2, they really did have autism. On the other hand, there's this young man who you would know something is up, but who also has a lot going for him. And so I think that we want to think both about what does it mean about autism, that some of these things can go away and some of them don't, and also to think ourselves about what are we trying to accomplish in treatment. This is just a slide which you don't even have to see, except you'll know that I'm involved in an AIM and in an ACE center with Connie Kosseri, and the goal there is to use this SMART technology where you start a treatment and then on the basis of whether the child responds, you randomize them into a different treatment or more of the same. And my point here is just that I think we want to move in these directions. And actually, Early Start Denver model does this even within the model of saying, am I seeing progress? What does this mean? Okay, what should I do next? And not just keep doing the same old stuff if it's not working. I think that seeing all these trajectories suggests to us that lots of things are changing in individuals, but there also are things that don't change if we don't work at them. So I think we need to have multiple goals for individuals. We need to keep monitoring what is happening, and then we need to have different strategies for different individuals. I think we also want to keep remembering that there are strengths and that those strengths really make a difference. And I think, you know, Temple Grandin talks about, you know, finding your passion and visual spatial skills. But I think that's also true in social skills. And I think that it's true within families. I think families have strengths. And trying to figure out how you can help a family identify what are they really good at with their child and what can they pull their child into and where do they need help from somebody else will get us farther than, again, having a sort of one-size-fits-all motto. So on that note, I'll just say many, many people did the research that I've talked about. These are just some of them. The families who have stuck with us for 20 years now, especially during that period of every 3 months doing Tanner scales and ABCs, have made such a huge difference. And I just wish we could find all of them. And then this, what I didn't say here was this research has been funded by NIMH, NICHD, NINDS. We've just went every place we possibly could, and that has made a huge difference. And Autism Speaks. So thanks to also all the people that helped us with this, and thank you for listening.
I'm a developmental pediatrician in charge of the early intervention program for the state of Nevada. So my question is about the ADOS-T. And your thoughts about specificity for these very young children, 13, 14, 15 months, whose cognitive scores are less than 15 months old. How do you feel about pursuing that diagnosis? Because parents really don't appreciate the nuances between a classification and a diagnosis. And it has to stand alone because I can't augment it with a CARS or a DSM, since those are two assessment tools normed for two-year-olds. So every day I'm getting phone calls from parents wanting to know why I'm not assessing their 14-month-old for autism.
Well, I think you can do it. It's just that those scores are not, you can't, you know, make a simple judgment that just because they have a high score, they have autism. I think you have a say in that, so that you as a clinician can say, you know, this child got this score because he did absolutely nothing throughout the whole ADOS, and I can't interpret that as autism or not autism. Or this child clearly had five very clear symptoms that were very specific to autism, and I'm going to do it. So I would say you can use it as a tool, but just, you know, you just have to add in, you know, your judgment of where it goes.
But are there studies about the specificity?
No. I mean, the specificity is not good, actually. That is the study. The specificity is not good when you get down into very low developmental levels. We thought, actually, I think, there also is, well, let's see. I think it wasn't 15 months, actually. With the toddler ADOS, it's down to about 12 months mental age. But there are going to be kids who come in lower. And I think there, and probably I shouldn't say this in public, but I would give them the diagnosis that will get them the most treatment. And then I would say to the family, this is what I'm doing. I am saying, if this will get you into a program that I think will help you, this is why I'm doing this, but I don't know. And then we have to reassess.
And also, I'm dealing with a couple of neurologists who use only the CARS, regardless. They always use a CARS on children under three, but over two, without looking at their cognitive score. And how reliable do you think
it's not at all.
It's not.
No.
So for children who cognitively are higher, you really want to use the ADAS. You don't want to use our cars. That's not why it was designed.
It wasn't. Okay. So it's just not, it just wasn't intended to do that.
Okay. So, but would you use it for a child with a very low cognitive score?
A car? I mean, I probably
along
wouldn't.
Along with the DSM?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what you gain from it, but it doesn't hurt.
Okay.
You know, in this study, right, the cars at 2 was actually quite predictive.
Okay.
But part of it is that it does add in an intellectual disability with autism, and so that's predictive of not having a great outcome. But it's definitely mixing up apples and oranges. So something can be predictive without being actually what you think it is.
So that's the problem. You still feel is most specific when assessed around 27 months, which is what previous studies have indicated.
I think it's, I mean, it's...
Under 2?
I think, yeah. Under 2, I think it's hard, but I think we got pretty reliable data from about 15 months up. We didn't have a lot of kids under 15 months. 15 months walking and a cognitive score, which is probably about 70 or so, and you're pretty good. Other than that, you've got kids who are quite delayed. And so I think I would hate to postpone treatment with those kids, because clearly something is wrong, you know. Yeah, so then...
Right. But, I mean, Kathy and I published a paper this fall of 97 children, 24 months and younger, from 12 to 24 months, diagnosed with ADAS-T initially, and followed up 3 months later and 12 months later, and all of them except one continued to have ASD even with treatment. So our data from that ADAS-T makes me think that it's quite useful and that it's quite a stable diagnosis for children who are referred by parents and screened appropriately and then seen.
I mean, I think another thing, just while we're on that topic, because Susan Rivera and I were talking about, the ADAS requires kids to be walking, and it would be really great if it didn't. But the problem is that if you can't walk, you might have other ways of getting around, like rolling or crawling, where your social behavior is quite different, or you may be immobilized and stuck. And that the ADAS is assuming the child can get away from you if they want. If you've got kids who can't walk, you could theoretically we could norm it by putting kids in, say, a sassy seat or something, and just saying everybody who can't walk has to go in the sassy seat, and then see how well it works. Some things might not work at all. Some things might work. So it is possible that that may work eventually, but we just don't know. And we don't want people concluding someone's autistic because they have poor eye contact because they're, you know, crawling around the room, and it's hard to get down there to look at them, or a kid who's falling over every time he grabs an object because he doesn't have the balance. So that's another, I mean, we've got limitations. Hi.
I have a lot of severely impaired adults who at some point in their development developed epilepsy, and I was wondering if that impacted on your study how many of the severely affected children ended up developing epilepsy in your study?
It was fewer than we thought. I mean, we were expecting, almost 25% of the kids before age 5 had 2 or more seizures. So, and that partly reflects the fact that we do have a lot of intellectually disabled kids. But then many of those kids got better. And actually, what was interesting there was that having seizures between 2 and 5 actually predicted slightly better progress than not having seizures, which is just goofy. When you control for IQ, wait a sec, Sally, because those kids got medicated, they were starting out worse than they probably should have been, and they get slightly better. So I'm not saying seizures are a good thing, but we expected 25% on the basis of Mike Rutter's data and various people to develop adolescent onset of seizures. And we don't have 25%. It's closer to about 15%. although they've been dribbling in. I mean, and still at 19, we have a couple kids who've had their first seizure, sometimes just one seizure. And it actually has been slightly more common in the severely disabled kids, but not only. We've also had some of the more able kids have had seizures. So it hasn't impacted outcome. Yeah, I mean, we thought it might, but at least from the trajectory from 9 to 14 to 19, it hasn't changed trajectories actually on anything. And that's why we did these crazy three-month repeated questionnaires, because we thought it might, but it hasn't. So I think the seizures are tough, but they, as far as we can tell, they don't result in, unless, I mean, we haven't had anybody who was in the hospital because of having going into status or anything like that. So that might have a different outcome, but just plain seizures, it actually hasn't.
I have a grandson who is autistic. He's going to be 7 years old the 25th of February. And he has very strong behavioral problems. I was wondering, is among the kids that you have been studying, if some of them had strong behavioral problems and they were given medicine, if the medicine did help?
We do have kids who have quite significant behavior problems. We have fewer of them, again, than we thought, compared to the kids in our clinic. We have fewer kids with severe behavior problems than we expected, but there are kids. We didn't really measure whether things changed radically with medication. We tried, because of the way that we collect data, we didn't really collect data once someone started a medication and then right after it saying, you know, is your child better? So we know that the kids with more behavior problems were more likely to be put on medication, but we don't know. I'm sorry.
In terms of sleep, is there any relationship between the quality of sleep and trajectory in your samples that develop optimally?
We don't know. The one place we've looked at it is irritability, and there's definitely a relationship between sleep and irritability, which I don't think would surprise anybody. So, we haven't really looked at it in a systematic way other than that.
So I was just wondering if you break down different types of repetitive behaviors, did, say, self-harming versus just sort of stereotype behaviors, did those have different predictive values across from 2 to 22?
Yes. They do, although the trouble is that they have different relationships with other behaviors, so it's a little bit hard to piece them, to take them out. But the repetitive movements and stereotype movements are related to IQ in our group. And so the kids who get better verbal skills typically have higher IQs and showed more decreases in repetitive behaviors than kids who didn't have that, acquisition of verbal IQ. Insistence on sameness was associated more with poor outcomes, but again, it's a little bit problematic because insistence on sameness is the one thing that we have that is not related to IQ. So there are people who are very smart who get very stuck on things, and there are people who are not so smart who get stuck on things. So it actually gives us more variability, which means that it looks like it predicts more because there's more variability. Self-injury, we don't have a lot of people who have self-injury. I mean, there's little things at age 2 where you have a kid who, like, bonks their head. But after age 2, we have some people, but it's very, really relatively few. And that was also related to IQ. So in that sense, related to outcome, but otherwise we couldn't tell. And sensory things we haven't looked at separate. We could. I mean, all we've got there is one ADI item and one ADAS item. So we don't have a lot of... we don't have a real comprehensive measure. We have the sensory processing scale, but it didn't link up with anything, actually, that we had. So good question, and I think we're going to try to get better information this round in order to better answer that.
Hi, Andrew Cavagnaro, a consulting psychologist. Were there any factors that protected children from depression and anxiety, or was that just that occur across all groups? Or it sounds like what you were just saying is that insistence on sameness may have been a factor.
It's really interesting because we thought maybe it would be a neat factor. It's not, and I'm slightly contradicting myself, but just because I can actually answer your question, but high insistence on sameness and high anxiety are not necessarily associated, but when you've got both of those, everything falls apart. So it isn't that every kid with high insistence on sameness was anxious, or that everybody who was anxious insisted on sameness. But when you do get both of those things, then you get depression, you get poor adaptive skills. Actually, I should be careful. Not always, but you get relationships with depression. So we were expecting maybe that we would have the kids who had insistence on sameness would be more anxious, but they weren't. But if they were anxious, then they had a really tough time. And where we saw it was in adaptive skills. I mean, their IQs could be very high, but their adaptive skills were low, and their social skills were lower. So that was something that was a little bit surprising about that. And there's actually, Kate Gotham, who's one of my former students, has a paper that just came out, actually, I think, or is it like an EPUB paper trying to describe that, because we had the same thought. The depression, it's a little bit hard because obviously if you can't talk very well, it's not easy to describe your own depression. So we have a slight association between a depression and higher IQ, at least over 70, or actually maybe basically verbal skills of a 5-year-old and higher. But that we don't know that people are really more depressed. It's just that they're more able to tell you, and their parents are more able to tell you, too. And we get the same thing that actually everybody else does. We have a group of people who do seem to have depression and not other things, except maybe anxiety. But we also have depressive symptoms in people with a lot of behavior problems. So you have a sad, well-behaved person, but you have just as many sad people who are making other people miserable. So it's both of those things. And we need to be careful, I think, to remember that you can have depression in somebody who's really being a pain and really difficult, as well as somebody who you feel more sympathy toward.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.